Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for August the 13th, 2018. This is David Corey along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Good evening, Richard.
Good evening, David. Tonight we have a special guest. We have Lauren Price. Lauren is a founder of the Public Affairs and a representative for a group called Veterans Warriors, which is based in Florida, but has a small agenda to help improve VA programs and services for veterans and their families. Lauren was on our show on October the 9th, 2017, to discuss various issues, and she is back with us again tonight to update us on the issues and more. And before I turn it over to David to interview a special guest, I want to remind everybody that this is a call-in show, and the number is 1-888-627-6008. That's 1-888-627-6008. So if you have any questions for David or myself, or especially for Lauren, please give us a call. Again, that number is 1-888-627-6008. David, back to you.
Thanks, Richard. Let me continue with the introduction of our guest. Lauren Price is the founder of Veterans Warriors, Veterans Advocacy Group with a national agenda. And she's led that organization since its creation in 2009. She's testified before Congress on veteran issues. As far as her career training and experience, she graduated from Omega Institute in New Jersey with her paralegal certification in 1987. She also has a bachelor's degree in criminal justice with a minor in psychology from St. Leo University. She has nearly two decades of experience in the legal profession. Of particular significance to our discussion tonight on this show, she served in the United States Navy for a decade between January 2005 and January 2015, including service for more than a year in Iraq as a convoy driver, as well as a public affairs officer in Baghdad. She also served as the Intel and Logistics Lead Petty Officer at the Defense Logistics Agency, United States Central Command. She co-founded the veterans group called Veterans Warriors with her husband, Jim Price, who is a retired Navy senior chief. Military service is a proud tradition in her family, with four of her five sons having served in the military. She is our special guest tonight on the Veterans News Hour to talk about her service in the Iraq War, as well as her experience dealing with the VA and fighting on behalf of the interests of veterans and their families, including sharing her experience testifying before Congress. So without further ado, I welcome Lauren Price to Veterans News Hour. How are you this evening, Lauren?
Just fine. Thank you very much for having me, Rick and David. Appreciate it.
Well, it's our privilege. We'd like to thank you. This is your second time on the show, and we appreciate you coming back to update us on many important issues. So we have lots to talk about, but let's begin with your experience serving in the Navy, including more than a year in Iraq. What was that like? What was it like driving convoys in Iraq, and what did your public affairs duties involve?
Well, it was always a combined duty. I was the lead convoy driver, and on most of our missions, I was the driver for our battalion commander. And we were civil affairs, so it was a whole lot of hearts and minds and glad-handing and, you know, kissing babies. So at the time, the tempo there was to really win over the Iraqis, and obviously we had to have a lot of pictures to show that, pictures and news stories. So get the colonel to where he had to be and get everybody there safely, and then walk around taking pictures and doing interviews with people. It opened my eyes a lot as far as getting to meet the Iraqis, both in the military personnel that we worked with, as well as the civilian locals. And they really are. They're just like us, you know, just want to go to work, you know, take care of their children, live their lives. They'd really wish all the fighting would end. But the best part was being able to bring everybody home, our entire convoy team, roughly about 25 people. We never lost a truck. And that was probably, believe it or not, my biggest accomplishment, and it's something I'm most proud of.
Wow. And what was it like, if you could kind of give us a description of what it was like being in a convoy, in Iraq, going through Baghdad? I'm sure it was a pretty harrowing experience.
Well, it was all things at all times. It was terrifying, thrilling, frustrating. You guys are in Tampa. You guys know what it's like, downtown traffic, on a Friday night when there's a game at Ray J. And now picture that two-thirds of the people on the road with you want to kill you. And every piece of trash on the side of the road potentially could blow up. That's what it's like. Baghdad is a very urban area. But then there's the fun stuff. And you develop a very deep camaraderie, especially very close with your teammates on the convoy team, because we are literally watching out for each other. And, doing things like driving like Dukes of Hazzard in downtown Baghdad, it became a necessary thing. But at the same time, it's, when you're out on the road and all of a sudden they call it turning black, it means it's deadly. That, there's attacks on the road, but you're actually on the road already. And now you get a message saying that, the route's turned black and you can't travel on it. Well, excuse me, where are we supposed to go with five convoy trucks now?
Right.
Or having one blow up. One time it was like 11 seconds before we got there, a truck took a hit. That's the kind of stuff that you literally lose sleep over.
Wow. If I could just add a slightly unrelated question, but when you mentioned, you were kind of giving us an idea of comparing it to traffic in the Tampa Bay area, during rush hour. I've lived in the Tampa Bay area for many years, and, it's a pretty congested area, pretty densely populated, but there's also a large military veterans presence because of Central Command, Special Ops Command, and MacDill Air Force Base, and I've just wondered, driving on the roads around here for the last, 10 to 15 years, do you think there possibly might be any correlation between what appears to be a much higher incidence of aggressive road rage driving and the fact that there are so many veterans that have come back from the war that have experienced that?
No.
No?
I've lived all over the United States, and I've driven in several foreign countries besides Iraq, and be assured that even before I ever went to Iraq, driving in Philly was way worse. driving in New York City, I did it for years, and it's way worse. And road rage crosses all gender and racial lines and everything else. Just being an idiot is not exclusive to those of us who've served overseas.
I wasn't going to use the I word that you just did. I was just wondering, though, and I've lived around the country in many states, having been in the military, and certainly have seen the road rage in different states, Arizona, California, et cetera. And I just remember when I lived in Arizona, it was almost like Wild West reputation out on the roads, and this was back in the 80s. So I get that. I was just wondering because it just seems to me as kind of, I'm digressing a bit from our discussion. We'll get back to it quickly, but. It just seems to me that the incidence of very aggressive driving and road rage in this area seems to have gotten worse in recent years. And I've often thought as I'm driving down the road and there are, whether there might be some veterans suffering from PTSD that are behind the wheel and they're just recovering from their Baghdad convoys. But I'm not in any way. Go ahead.
I will tell you this. The biggest thing that it did to me as far as driving, because when I came home, I had 7 days leave and then went right to my job. I got assigned to Defense Logistics Agency. And I had to commute from Newport Richey to MacDill every day.
That's a long drive.
It's a long drive. And when I started going through treatment for PTSD under the VA, one of the programs that they had me in brought on some really severe flashbacks. And it was so bad that I would have to pull over. So the opposite was happening for me. And the veterans I've talked to since then over the years, just the opposite happens with us. That losing control thing, if anything, we're more fearful to drive. We're more fearful to be on the road. And because we know, you know, for us it was life and death. So it just the opposite happens is we don't actually go looking for it. We, if anything, shy away from it and try to get out of the situation. Because we don't want to feel that way. We don't want to be afraid. So if anything, I think it's the congestion. I've lived in Tampa Bay for 15 years. And when I bought my house in Newport Richey, all the major roads, 50, 52, 54, were one lane each way, and they were nothing but cattle ranches out there.
Right.
Now, you cannot find a buildable lot, let alone acreage, anywhere in West Pasco, anywhere.
Right.
It just doesn't exist any longer because there's so much, and I think I just saw something recently that Pasco County is growing at the rate of 19% a month. That's what's driving this. It's just too many people.
Right. Well, I didn't mean it all in any way just to overly simplify it to make it sound like the road rage problem is just due to veterans. I was just wondering, you know, to get your insights, and I appreciate that. Let's turn our discussion to a couple issues I know you have tremendous expertise on, and that's the open air burn pits. And then if we have time, talk about the VA's program for caregiver support. Let's talk about the burn pits, too. Maybe you could start with your own personal struggles and then tell us about the legislation that was recently proposed in Congress dealing with the harm to U.S. service members caused by those open-air burn pits.
Well, there's the beginning of it. Like most things for people, it was very personal for me. When I got back from Iraq, I had gotten sick when I was over in Iraq. Like a lot of my teammates on the convoy team, we all got sick about halfway through the tour with what basically everybody calls the Iraqi crud. And I didn't recover. Like I came home, you know, 9 months later, I was still sick. And I was still coughing all the time. I couldn't catch my breath. And going through my redeployment medical, some x-rays kept popping up saying that they thought I had TB. So obviously this is a concern. So when I got to MacDill and doing my in-processing medical, they kept saying the same thing. Well, it looks like you have TB. So finally they sent me to a civilian doctor because they had shut down all the specialties at MacDill Air Force Base. And the civilian doctor did a lung biopsy. So I'm really sorry to tell you this, but no, it's not. You don't have TB. He said, it kind of looks like you inhaled Drano.
Wow.
Some really great color pictures of it. And he didn't know what it was. He knew he had approximately 75 other soldiers that he was treating. I won't give his name now because he's now actually employed by the VA. But he had 75 other soldiers he was treating at the time that all were coming. We'd all recently got home. We all had these weird upper respiratory or lung problems, all reporting the same kind of symptoms. I was the first one he'd done a lung biopsy on, and he did the only thing that pulmonologists know to do is, you know, here's a big bunch of steroids, really high-dose steroids, and a bunch of inhalers, and we'll just do the best we can with this. And none of that stuff worked. And fast forward until after I retired, I crushed the basal joint in both hands, which is the ball that holds your thumbs on. And had to have essentially partial amputations. They had to go in and take those bones out and remove them and reroute tendons and everything. So I got retired because of it. And after I retired, I went for a second opinion because I wasn't getting better. I was getting worse. And even the drugs they were giving me weren't working. It's like, there's got to be something else going on. And I went to see a doctor in Nashville. His name is Dr. Robert Miller, and he's one of the three specialists in the nation that actually is researching this. And he determined that I have what's called constrictive bronchiolitis, and it's a terminal disease. You will die from it. There's no cure. Turns out steroids actually don't help it. They make it worse.
Wow.
And that all they can do is treat the symptoms. And Tampa General had turned me down for a lung transplant because the only thing they can determine is that it was some kind of chemical in my body. And because they can't get rid of it, they don't know exactly what chemical or combination of them are, so they won't give me lungs because they're just going to die. And doing this research to figure it out, because that's what you mentioned earlier, that I've had my paralegal degree since, say, 1987. Paralegals are researchers. This is what we know how to do. And in doing that research, I discovered that nearly every single thing that was burned in these pits while we were over there, and every single place had a pit. Every place had a pit or a space against a T-wall, or I have some great pictures of Fab and Yusufia where they don't even have a pit. They just basically pile everything up against a T-wall and burn it. Everything has chemicals that are emitted from it. And the very first thing I found was a DOD regulation that was put up during the first Gulf War about the paint on every piece of military equipment. It's called CARC paint. It's corrosion-resistant paint. Every nut, every bolt, every piece of metal, everything is painted with it. They found out in the first Gulf War that it becomes a super carcinogen when it's burned. And they've made this very strict regulation on, you know, if you have to weld it or you have to get caught on fire or whatever. Everybody's got to get respirators and all this. Well, I personally had taken four pickups, 998 pickups, full of junk left over in our motor pool to the burn pit. And they were all parts off of vehicles and everything. And I'm freaking out. I'm like, why would we do this? Why would we burn this in an open-air pit? And the more I researched, the more I discovered that not only is this a common practice, but that it was openly sanctioned. And our work initially pushed and got the incinerators. And when I worked at Defense Logistics Agency, I handled the RFIs and the RFQs and the orders and the transport and the shipping of those incinerators into theater. And then a few years go by, and we find out that the incinerators aren't being used. In fact, they're allowing the ground commanders to disregard using them. The special investigator for the Afghan reconstruction, in several reports over the course of several years, scathing reports about the DOD's blatant refusal to use the incinerators. And even though there is a regulation that was laid down in 2009 that said you will use them, you will not have an open-air burn pit over 90 days or if the camp exceeds 100 inhabitants, yet they continue to do it. So we've been pushing and building evidence and building support. And when I first met Congressman Bill Rackus, I was sick, but I didn't know how sick yet. And it was when I figured out how sick I was that I talked to him about the burn pit. And since then,
Lauren,
we've been... Yeah, I'm sorry.
Lauren, could I just jump in for 1 second?
Sure.
For our listeners, and I want you to get right back to Bill Rackus, but describe the size of these burn pits.
Oh, geez. The one at Camp Victory?
You know, when I talk to people and I try to, you know, tell them, because I've seen a documentary on it, and I've seen photos and stuff, and until you see them, you just can't believe how huge they are.
Yeah,
so if you could just describe...
Yeah, no one actually can believe, like, they think we're exaggerating, and we're
exactly.
not.
Exactly.
The one at Victory Base Complex, which was Camp Liberty, Camp Victory, Camp Stryker, and included Camp Trash Can. Victory Base Complex was actually a bunch of FOBs when they finally got them secured in an area. It was about 40 square miles of base small FOBs that all came together. It was the largest burn pit in Iraq. Everybody talks about Balad. Balad was actually the one that was studied the most. But the one at BBC was the biggest and operated the longest. And I helped Dan Rather actually get his producers in there to do his report that he did in 2008 on the burn pits. The idea is that people don't understand, like, picture the entire floor of Ray J Stadium, the entire floor, the entire field. That's the burn pit. And they pour jet fuel on it, JP8. It's not diesel. Diesel actually burns really much lower and much slower. This is jet fuel. It's JP8, and it's dumped on there to keep the fire burning because everything burns at different temperatures. And when you're talking about burning a piece of metal off an up-armored Humvee, you've got to have a really high temperature to burn that versus burning a mattress or computer parts or batteries or plastic water bottles. So they use the jet fuel because it will burn the hottest and continue to burn everything off. So when you're talking about something, it would be as if we were using Ray J Stadium to burn our garbage.
Wow.
Yeah, people don't grasp the how big this thing was.
Yeah, I know in the Burn Pit documentary, I think one of the people in the film talked about one, and I'm not sure which installation, but it was like a 10-acre burn pit, burning 24 hours.
That's a lot.
Yeah, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it was putting out a haze, a fog, just smoke that was hugging the ground. It was just amazing. So, tell us, Lauren, tell us about, for our listeners that may not be as knowledgeable, that aren't as knowledgeable, the current status of the VA rules for disability compensation, and then this proposed legislation which Congressman Bill Arrakis from Florida just introduced a couple weeks ago.
Well, first and foremost is back in 2010, excuse me, the Department of Veterans Affairs put out very quietly a thing called the Environmental Training Letter. I know it's a policy. The whole document is 26 pages long. The first 9 pages of it specifically prescribes, and it's from the VA leadership, from the secretary, to every single VA facility and in the country. And it prescribes how they are supposed to handle rating burn pit claims. And it's important to note that in that document, it states very clearly and repeatedly that veterans and service members are going to report a galaxy of symptoms that may not seem to be connected. And by virtue of, if you actually go and read this document, which anybody that wants it, I'm happy to give it to you. It's on our website. It's on our Facebook page. It talks about how they're supposed to take the lead and treat this, if that person served in either Iraq, Afghanistan, or Djibouti, that they're supposed to take the lead and treat it as a burn pit claim. Yet, we sat in a roundtable a month ago with a deputy director for the VBA, who first and foremost is proud to tell everybody in the world that they have literally only approved 2,000 claims for burn pit exposures. Then she turned around in the next breath and threw every veteran in the nation who's been sick from this under the bus and made us at fault when questioned by one of the congressmen sitting in the meeting why they didn't approve more of them. Well, the veteran has to tell us that it's a burn pit claim. They have to document it. Well, ma'am, as a matter of fact, no, that's not what your policy that's 8 years old says. And when I pulled the document out of my binder and showed it to her, I said, this is the document. Why are you, do you train your staff, your rating examiners on this? Well, we make available continuing education for them. And I changed the question. I said, do you mandate that they take this training so that they know how to rate these claims? Well, no, we have the training available to them. So I tend to be very sarcastic and very flippant, and I don't have a whole lot of respect for people that talk to me like I'm stupid. So I looked her in the face and said, I look across the room to the VSOs who are all prior military. And I said, which one of you guys over there would ever sit still for a mandatory PowerPoint? And they all, none of them, they're like, nope, nope. You know, would you volunteer for a PowerPoint training? No, none of us would. So you're telling me nobody is mandated to take this training to be trained on how to rate these clients? No, they're not.
Wow.
So we, for the last 2 years, have spent every spare minute we have researching how to deal with the burn pits and to deal with the fact that no matter what, we're going to be at war somewhere. And because of the highly kinetic operation that a combat operation is, they're going to go into a place and they're not going to be able to bring an incinerator with them. They're going to be bringing the Marines in first and, you know, surround and drown everything with fire and hope that something lives. That's how it works. So we have to recognize that this is a method of waste disposal for initial operations. However,
right,
we need to deal with the after effects of that, which some people are going to get sick. And whether it's a genetic predisposition to it or anything else, my husband served side by side with me over there. Same place. Went on a lot of the same missions. He doesn't have this. A lot of my team members do not have this. I'm still in communication with some of them. They don't have it. Some of them have other diseases, though. So we have to address this, and we have to look at it from a realistic standpoint, and we have to learn lessons from what they being the VA, have done with our brothers and sisters from that served in Vietnam.
Agent
so
Orange,
we developed this legislation. Yeah, well, they ignored it for 34 years. They fought it tooth and nail. And as of today, they are still fighting it. They're still fighting giving benefits to Blue Water Navy. They're still fighting to the River Rats. Everybody at the VA is fond to say, we don't have the money. It's going to be too expensive. And in the same sentence, if you make us give these benefits to these veterans, we are going to have to cut benefits for some other thing. And their current threat is that they're going to cut benefits in the mortgage side, in the lending side, to grant Blue Water Navy benefits. So we said, well, first and foremost, let's remember something. The VA doesn't have a checkbook. They don't get to decide who they grant benefits to. They work at the behest of Congress. Secondly, every single time Congress grants more benefits to a veteran, Congress does so with the full knowledge that we have to pay for this somehow. So when the budget request comes in, the VA budget gets approved every year. It has not been cut or denied for 15 years. So the next time you hear the VA squawking about, oh, well, they're going to have to cut benefits somewhere to grant benefits for something like the burn pits, laugh in their face and remind them that they don't ever get their budget cut. Because this legislation is ours. Congressman Bill Ruckus and Congressman Ruiz out of California. He's also Dr. Ruiz. He's a public health researcher and an emergency medicine doctor. And they co-sponsored this bill. And this bill will grant presumptives. There's going to be a commission set up that is independent of the VA. They will not have any control over it. The commission will sit for a year to examine existing research and not just DOD or not just VA, but CDC and WHO and EPA and all the independent research done by universities around the world. That commission will sit and develop a list of presumptives. And after the press conference announcing that the bill had been submitted, I met with the congressman because our office is also working with an organization called Hunter 7. Hunter 7 has done all the research that some members of Congress are claiming we still need. They've already done it. So we're going to have meet with Hunter 7, and we're going to hand this research to the commission because then all the research they claim they need, they will have. Because what we'd like to see is instead of a presumptive based on a location and date of service, we're going to base it on the chemicals found in those locations.
Yeah.
Because
Lauren, let me just interrupt you real quick, just for the mm-hmm. for the benefit of our listeners that may have just tuned in. Our special guest tonight is Lauren Price, the head of a veterans group called Veteran Warriors. If you have a question for Lauren, our toll-free call-in number is, grab a pen and paper, it's 1-888-627-6008. Again, 1-888-627-6008. And Lauren, correct me if I'm wrong, but just for our listeners that may be really interested in the details, this legislation is H.R. 6582, is that correct?
Yes, and it's protection for veterans with exposures to burn pits.
And it was introduced by Congressman Gus Bilirakis, who's from the Tampa Bay area of Florida, and he's on the House Veterans Affairs Committee, so he's a pretty powerful member of Congress with expertise in veteran issues, which is great to see that he's behind this. Now, let me ask you, Lauren, about this legislation. When you mentioned creating presumptives, but a presumptive list, you know, I know many of our veteran listeners, particularly those that served in Vietnam, they're familiar with the regulations that deal with the list of cancers and diseases that the VA will presume are associated with Agent Orange. Now, the presumptive list for exposure to the toxic substances from these open-air burn pits, as I understand the legislation, correct me if I'm wrong, is the legislation itself doesn't create a list, but it creates, and I think as you indicated a moment ago, a commission basically that will examine the medical research and then come up with a list that they then propose to the Secretary of the VA. Am I right on that? Is that?
Well, almost. That commission will give that list, and the list is not created yet, and we've already had some confusion about this, and our organization has no control over what's going to be in that list. We are going to have input into all the data that's going into it, but that commission will come up with a list of diseases that will be presented to the House Committee on Veterans Affairs.
I see.
And they will be handing that list. Once this thing is a law, all they'll do is they will review the list, and then they will forward it to the Secretary, and the Secretary will have 60 days to implement it. And for those listeners who don't understand what presumptives mean, it means that it is assumed that your illness is as a direct result of your service without having to go through all of the medical stuff or years, and everybody's heard about the years-long backlogs and claims. You don't have to go through all of that. It's you were there, you got this disease. By law, they have to grant you benefits for it.
Now, Lauren, if I could jump in for a second, that list, that presumption, is that going to be an irrebuttable or a rebuttable?
Irrebuttable, because it's going to be based on scientific evidence, not on biased and hard-fought, discussion that the VA and the DOD continue to say now that there's no conclusive evidence that burning tires with jet fuel doesn't cause cancer.
I think one thing, if I could add to that, one thing that we want to make sure as this legislation and then the subsequent actions work is that it's a little known fact in the regulation is that for Agent Orange as well as for the Camp Lejeune presumptive list, there is language in there about it being rebuttable on an individual basis. In other words, if a particular veteran's medical history established that it was more likely due to some other reason, then they might rebut it. Now, the VA has not, in my experience, been very aggressive in doing that, but that's something to to watch out for.
Well, we're aware of that, and it's actually we're probably more aware of it ourselves, and meaning the group of us that put this together, because we saw what happened when I was also part of the original group that got the burn pit registry. And as with many things that happened with the VA, Congress passed a law, told them to do it, gave them the funding to do it, and then literally just turned their back and said, okay, you guys take care of it. The VA turned that into a goat rope. And we did the beta testing, and we told them that the questions that they asked were not related to our service, that they literally asked questions like things I could pull up. I actually still have the beta test questions. Things like, did my mother, smoke pot when she was pregnant? Just bizarre things like this. Where did we live when I was growing up? That was setting the grounds for that rebuttal. That burn pit registry, those questions on there actually set the grounds for the rebuttal, for them to be able to rebut any veteran's claim that they got sick from the burn pit. Well, we are aware of this. So if you look right now, that language isn't in there because this actually won't establish the presumptive list. It's a discussion that is going to be in there when we have this, when we start going through markup, which that may or may not even have to happen. There's also some discussion of we may be asking the president for an executive order because so many of us are sick. Right now, there's over 140,000 people that registered on that registry, and there's roughly 160,000 that never completed registering because there's so many questions that have no relation to anything, and they got frustrated. Last February, the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and something, I forgot their full title, they distributed a congressionally mandated study of the efficacy of that registry. And the key statement at the end of it is, in the summary section, 294-page report, it says it's useless. The data is useless. The questions are bad. It's poorly written. It's poorly formatted. Oh, and we can't even extract data out of it because of the way they constructed this thing. So it's basically a black hole. All it's doing is people get on there and register. The rating examiners can't see the information. They can't access it. Medical providers, all they see is a checkbox that you are registered on the burn pit registry. It does nothing. So we looked at this. They set it up like this so that they could refute claims. They could go in and look and say, well, you answered this question that says, your mom smoked pot when she was pregnant with you, and therefore, we're going to deny your claim.
We're going to put
language in markup that stops that.
Let me, my point of comparison, Lauren, let me just, we've had on our show before Jerry Ensminger, whose daughter died of cancer after exposure to the Camp Lejeune contaminated water. And in 2012, Congress passed a law named for Janie Ensminger. And in that law, Congress put in a statute as opposed to a regulation, a list of 15 health conditions that if a veteran or family member had it, they'd be eligible for health care. Now, that's not the disability compensation that we're talking about right now, but it's for health care for the Camp Lejeune. And the good thing was they put it in the statute. Now, we know from talking to Jerry that even he would admit that because of the political process, there may be some diseases on that list of 15 that maybe actually shouldn't have been on there, but they got on there, okay? Now, we fast forward a couple years from 2012 to 2017. The VA does the regulatory thing, comes up with a list of 8, so a little more than half of the other list, and they do this for their list of 8 presumptive disabilities for Camp Lejeune contaminated water for disability compensation purposes. And where I'm going with this explanation is it would seem to me ideal, and I realize you can tell us more about whether you think it's politically realistic, is, there already have been so many studies, and we already know the DOD and the VA is going to be saying that, it's impossible to study things and get any more definitive answer. why can't Congressman Bill Arrakis and maybe some others get behind some legislation that says, all right, we're going to cut through all this. We're going to pass a law that says here's 8 or 10 or 12, whatever the number is of conditions, and just put it into a statute to kind of prevent this endless hamster wheel of studying stuff to death, you know, that may end up like another camp or Agent Orange thing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's why we're at this point now, and that's why this language was crafted so carefully in this bill, because there was a hearing on the burn pit on June 7th, and then there was the roundtable, and we weren't invited to speak at the hearing we attended. Actually, only the VA and two VSO representatives were allowed to speak at the hearing. Well, the roundtable.
What kind of hearing was this? What kind of hearing was this? The House Committee.
House Committee. That one was by Subcommittee on Health. The roundtable was a joint roundtable for the DAMA, which is Disability Memorial Affairs, and the Subcommittee on Health. And
now, Lauren, at this hearing, who from Congress was present?
The entire committee. The entire subcommittee was there, as well as there were other representatives that were there because they demanded to sit into this hearing. As being a member of Congress, they can. Dr. Ruiz was there, Mr. Castro, Chelsea Gabbard was there. Gus was there. Brian Mass was there. That was actually entertaining to watch Congressman Ruiz from California and Congressman Mast out of South Florida watch the two of them basically eat the VA guy alive.
Wow.
It's on C-SPAN. If you really want some fun, watch it. It was Brian Mast, who I've done a couple radio shows with before. It was entertaining to watch him because he was very calm, but the way he was, he would say, so if I, you know, wanted to burn batteries, do you think that would be bad? And you know, when I think of, and he just kept going, but he was very calm about it. But he was talking over the VA guy because he's like, well, what if I wanted to burn this and I wanted to burn that and I wanted to burn this? Basically driving the point home that these are all the things that are in the burn pit that keep telling us how it's not going to kill you. The thing about it is we got actually a lot more information and we're able to drive the point home during that roundtable, which is a closed-door thing. And it's important to note that both at the hearing and at the roundtable, the DOD was invited. The DOD backed out at the very last minute of the hearing, and when invited to the roundtable, they immediately refused to attend. They do not want anybody to hear that they are going to go on the record and saying, we don't have burn pits operating. Well, we know for a fact that they do. I've got a soldier downrange in Taji that's sending me pictures of the one operating in Taji. They claim that the Iraqis are running that burn pit, but the contractor takes the waste from the base to the burn pit. So they're still doing it. They just now figured out a third way of doing it so that they're not operating it.
Yeah, if I could just interject there, I think that would be a concern, because the big picture issue here is whether our troops are exposed to the toxic stuff from open burn pits in their military service, and this is usually an overseas area, obviously. It shouldn't matter whether the burn pit was operated by a contractor, by a local national, or by the DOD. And I noticed in this legislation that they define an open burn pit as an area of land that, quote, is designated by the Secretary of Defense to be used for disposing of solid waste by burning in outdoor air. And I saw that language is designated by the Secretary of Defense, and I'm thinking, I wonder if that's a loophole that the DOD is going to try to say, like, oh, we didn't, like you were just alluding to, oh, we, the DOD, didn't designate that. That's a contractor. That's Halliburton or KBR or somebody, or a host national or Iraqi.
And we actually are just dealing with that right now because the pictures that came out of Taji, and Taji is one of the oldest labs in Iraq, and the guy's still there, and he's taking pictures, and we're keeping his identity confidential, and I scrub his pictures so that there's no metadata on him. Nobody can figure out who this guy is. The first thing that happened was the DOD said, it's not us, it's a contractor. The contractor said, it's not us, it's actually the Iraqi nationals. The Iraqi National Army is running that burn pit, and they actually said that. Their contract says that they take the waste from our base to that dump, which is literally at the end of the base. So the pictures I have of this soldier, there's no way he's not breathing this because he's close enough to it to be breathing this every day. So
right.
The whole thing is nonsense.
Yeah, my point, Lauren, though, is that language in the legislation where it defines open burn pit.
Unfortunately, our problem is this. We're trying to get the presumptives in. Our original bill that went to Congress to get submitted, two big things got cut out of it. One was the DOD side of this about the DOD operating burn pits and whether or not they're operating them or KBR is or third party or whoever. And the other piece was about, as you know, you guys know because you saw the documentary, about the liability clauses. Those indemnity clauses, we want those stripped off, and we want them voided out. Well, I've been promised by Congressman Villarakis that when Congress goes back in session next month, that we're going to have some discussions with the Armed Forces Committee, that we're going to be having some discussions with some of their rank and file and their leadership. Because there's some pieces there that need to have some very frank discussions with them, because we may be crafting a second piece of legislation that this piece talks about getting people the benefits and the care that they need and they've earned.
Right.
This other piece is we're going to have to tackle it from the armed services side, because that's where they already have a regulation that says they're not supposed to do this.
Right.
They define that anyway.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, literally one more law is not going to change what they're doing. What we now need is some repercussions for them breaking that law or that violating that regulation.
Right.
So, and I did need to mention something before I forget. Everybody knows about Camp Lejeune. Like, you have to live under a rock to not know about Camp Lejeune.
Right.
It's really important to note that Camp Lejeune no one knew about it, and nobody, especially the VA, cared about it until that environmental training letter came out in 2010. Because the presumptives and the statutory language that created them, that moved at light speed. Because that regulation came out in April of 2010, and in 2012, 2 short years, there was legislation for them. Statutory language granting them medical care. We have been fighting this for 10 years now.
Go ahead, Rick.
Lauren, on the Camp Lejeune, as David said, we had Jerry Esminger on the phone on our show, and you know, he was talking about, you know, when that legislation finally got to Obama's desk, it had been, you know, the subject of a lot of compromise. And David was alluding to the fact that some of the conditions, medical conditions, shouldn't have been on there and vice versa.
Well, that wasn't my opinion. That was Jerry's point, yeah.
Yeah, but still, I mean, do you see that kind of happening with the burn pit?
Not right now. Here's what I do know, and this is from having sat through numerous meetings about this with just all these things.
They start to compromise legislation.
Well, that's a typical thing, and I've been working in D.C. long enough to know that that is exactly how this happens, that nothing's perfect, and we always end up with a compromise.
Right.
However, the biggest discussion that's happened is there's two, well, in particular, and I won't name names, there's two congressmen that have repeatedly stated and pushed the VA that we need to study this longer and we need to study this more, and one of them basically patting the VA on the back for deciding to now just now, in the last 2 months, set up a tracking system to track vet service members as they move around from base to base, so that 30 years from now, they can know if they served at a base and if they got sick from that base. That's great. They actually, even these same congressmen even offered the VA more money to do more studies. Here's the thing. One of the studies they wanted to do, and they've said this, that same person has said this repeatedly now, that they wanted to study the locals in Iraq and Afghanistan to find out if they are getting the same diseases, these same rare diseases. And if so, perhaps it might even be, and I'm quoting here, that it might be a pathogen, which is a contagious disease. Now, I'm not a medical professional. I worked in the legal community. But there, to the best of my knowledge, there is not one disease that will track through two countries over 17 years. And also create all of these different types of things, rare cancers, rare blood disorders, autoimmune diseases, lung conditions, skin rash, just pick a disease. So the ridiculousness of that statement proved to me that those are the people that I'm going to have to shove, like, real research down their throats. And yeah, when I discovered that Hunter 7 has the research that was done by the U.S. Army on detainees in those nations, they did research on these people. They did study them for pathogens and all that stuff. The Army did it, and Hunter 7 got that research.
Lauren, I hate to interrupt, but we're about out of time for tonight. We've just got about a minute left, so if you could tell us, I want to thank you for being on our show, but if you could tell our listeners real quick where they can find out more information about your organization, Veteran Warriors, and what you recommend they do to support the efforts on this burn pit issue.
You guys can, anybody can find us. We're on Facebook at Veteran Warriors Advocacy is a group. We also have a public veterans page that's wide open for everybody. That's at Vet Warriors One on Facebook. We also have a website, veteranwarriorsadvocacy.com. And if nothing else, look for me. And that's my whole life is this work, so I can find, I can steer you to where you need to go. And we need you to talk to your congressman. Get your congressman on board to co-sponsor HR 6582.
Great. Thank you so much, Lauren, for being on our show and for all the great work you're doing for veterans. We'd like to invite you back whenever it's convenient for you to keep our listeners updated. Thanks again. Have a great week. And for our listeners, thanks for tuning in. We're about out of time for tonight. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. I'd like to thank our producer, Mr. Doug Newsom. And we'd ask you to tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, hope you have a great week. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.